Micro Byte.
Hello and welcome to Microbyte, brought to you by the people that bite the hand that feeds IT. I'm Gavin Clark, software editor for The Register.
And I'm Mary Jill Foley with the All About Microsoft blog at ZDNet. In today's show, we're going to start off by talking about Windows 7, everybody's favorite topic. We're going to ask whether Windows 7 is really the best thing since sliced bread, or is it just a Wonder Bread wrapper?
And Microsoft tried to crash Adobe's Mix conference recently by trampling all over the RIA news with news about Silverlight 3. Microsoft broke protocol, and in doing this, what was behind that? Is Microsoft feeling under pressure from Adobe? We'll find out.
On the anniversary of the much-hated Microsoft Novell tie-up, we're going to try to figure out who benefited. Was it Microsoft, Novell, customers, or no one?
And finally, you love it and we love it, Todd Ballmer's patented Steve Ballmer Mood Index. What mood is Steve Ballmer in this time, now that Yahoo's in the middle of a CEO search?
So let's start off today, Gavin, by talking about Windows 7.
Okay.
As you recall, at the PDC, Microsoft's Professional Developers Conference, which was at the end of October, everyone was writing really positive initial reviews of Windows 7. Even people who hadn't even tried out the product were saying it was really unbelievable and it was finally going to be the answer to Microsoft's prayers on Windows. A week later, we saw a lot of other reviews coming in that were almost 180 degrees the reverse, saying that, hey, can you believe it? Windows 7 is nothing but Vista R2. Surprise! So it's a little difficult right now, that given that we're still at a pre-beta, to figure out what Windows 7 really is. Is it going to be the salvation of Microsoft's Windows business, or isn't it?
Right. I mean, I feel, as I was saying at the time, I felt we were all being subtly spun by Steven Sinofsky. The message was Windows 7 is better than Vista, and lo and behold, people came away with saying, hey, it's better than Vista.
Yeah. But what's hard to, you know, to a little bit to Microsoft's defense here, I'll say that we are only seeing M3 at this point, which is a pre-beta release. And it's pretty unusual for reviewers to actually benchmark a pre-beta. And we're seeing a lot of people start to do that because Microsoft's been confident enough to give out the code without any real restrictions on it. In a way, they're getting what they deserve by giving out the code like that. But it is very early in terms of stages of Windows to be doing something like that too.
Right.
I think it would be interesting just to bring up as a reminder where we're at in the schedule of Windows 7. Microsoft's still saying publicly that Windows 7 is going to be an early 2010 product, but we're past the point of anybody believing that at this point.
Right.
Everybody is starting to come around to the idea that it's going to be available in time for holiday 2009. I'm even hearing RTM whisper dates of June 2009.
Right.
Which is just a little over 6 months away, which means we're going to see a beta one very soon. I'm still hearing beta one before Christmas, one release candidate, and boom, RTM, which
right.
is very different from how Windows has been done in the past.
Right.
And I think it's worth also noting that Windows 7 Server, the product that's really called Windows Server 2008 R2, what a mouthful,
yeah.
Is in total lockstep with Windows 7. So if Microsoft is really on this much of an ambitious release for Windows 7 client, we could also see a release of Windows 7 Server next year.
How does it stand out compared to previous release cycles?
For a server?
Yeah.
Server is on a little more of a dependable cycle. It's not usually plagued as much by delays and kind of features falling in and out of the product, at least not publicly. Because the server team is claiming this is a minor release of their product, I think the expectations are a little bit lower. The client team is still persisting in saying this is a major Windows release that they're going to be having with Windows 7. So the expectations are a lot higher there.
Right. Now, to your point about the resetting of expectations on Windows Vista, when I was at PDC, I spoke to one of the guys we featured in the series of similar interviews we did walking around the show floor, a guy called Josh Bernard, who's a manager of software development. He said he held strong reservations about Windows 7, saying he felt there was a lot of eye candy. He wanted to get into the guts of the system. I don't think his views have changed since then. But we had a question from him, and I think maybe you'd be in a good position to maybe field this one, MJ. He kind of wanted to find out a little bit more about what's going on behind the scenes. He said, you know, as a techie, he's always getting asked by his kind of casual PC using friends why their PC is running so slow, you know, and what can they do to make it run faster when they come out with a new machine. Usually, he says he has to resort to the list of Windows services to find out what's starting automatically, or he has to go through or find out what miscellaneous programs are being fired up at the startup. So his big thing this time is he wants to find out what's Microsoft doing to help the poor novice take control of their computer and get rid of all that kind of third-party bloatware.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think Microsoft is doing two things. One thing they're doing is a program called Velocity. And under the Velocity program, Microsoft is working with PC makers to try to convince them to take some of the quote-unquote crapware off their machines. Because as we know, as PC users, one of the reasons that PCs are such a horrendous out-of-the-box experience compared to a Mac is when you get a brand new PC, it's loaded down with all kinds of free trialware and this and that that people don't want, but PC makers put on there because they get money for it. Mm. So there's, you know, Microsoft can only go so far in what they can do. The Department of Justice would really come down hard on them if they go to a PC maker and say, hey, take all this off there. We're telling you what to do. So they're walking a very thin line there, but they're trying to encourage PC vendors to think more about the consumer when they're designing an out-of-the-box experience. Mm-hmm. And a couple PC vendors have shown machines where there's a much improved Windows Vista experience. I've seen some of the new Sonys and a couple of the new HP entertainment PCs, and they're much decrapified. Mm. And it's a big, big difference. And I think if Microsoft can get more OEMs to buy in on that, that's going to help a lot.
Do you think people have learned their lesson? I mean, back about 8 years ago, people were loading a lot of crapware onto their machine, stuff which just slowed the whole thing down.
Yeah. I think people have learned the lesson. And even PC makers who would love to get that money from some of the antivirus vendors and some of the services vendors, they are realizing it's a real trade-off. And if you make PCs too junked up, people just aren't going to buy them.
Right.
And the other thing that Microsoft's doing, and we saw a little of this at WinHack, which is the Windows Hardware Engineering Conference that happened in early November, is Microsoft also is taking some of the services that used to come on automatically with Windows at startup and is making them start up later. So they're kind of trying to prioritize which services should be there at startup. Mm-hmm. And I think that also is going to really speed up PCs in the Windows 7 timeframe if Microsoft comes through in what they've shown so far.
Is there any indication yet about what services are going to be prioritized?
No. They're being somewhat cagey about that, but they've shown some demos where, you know, things that are more background services or things that you don't really need right off the bat usually when you start up Windows, say printing services, mm-hmm. don't need to start up when you first boot your machine.
Yeah.
And that really could also have quite a good effect on performance.
That's something Josh was kind of hinting at. The printing services was one thing he picked up about how you don't always need it, but mm-hmm. when you do need it, you need a great experience.
Yeah. And I think let's talk a little bit more about Windows 7 Server again,
yep.
Because I feel like people aren't really grokking the idea right now that Windows 7 Server and Windows 7 Client are being built from the same code base. And so a lot of the services that Microsoft's showing in one or the other, you're going to see come together when they announce the final versions of those two products. In fact, what Microsoft's doing, and this is really clever on their part, they're tying some of the services together so that they'll only work if you have both Windows 7 Server and Windows 7 Client installed at your location. An example of this is a feature called Direct Access. And Direct Access is going to be available in the Windows 7 timeframe. It's going to allow users to forego a VPN but still have a direct and secure networking connection. So this is going to be a real boon to corporate users who want to use their corporate PC at home.
Mm-hmm.
But the way that's going to work is you have to have Windows 7 on your client and Windows 7 Server as your server. And so Microsoft's really thinking about how can we get people to upgrade both client and server when they come out in tandem.
Yeah.
And we've got a guest here too who was at WinHack named Stephen Bink, who runs the bink.nu website, and he's a real expert on Windows Server matters, and he had some interesting points of observation from when he was at the show recently.
But I'm curious what you find most interesting and why. Well, besides Hyper-V 2.0 with its new features, which is its major live migration of virtual machines without any downtime, dynamic memory, but that feature might not make it. But the most thing I like the most is direct access. Some of you might be familiar with the Outlook Anywhere feature, that you can start Outlook anywhere in the world, in your hotel, at home, and you are directly connected to the Exchange server. Now they're going to do this with the file servers that are within your corporate network, so you can access them from anywhere, literally. And this feature was first announced in R2 of 2003 server, but that feature got skipped. And now they're going to try it again, but they're going to try it in a better way. Yeah, so with direct access, you can access your files or your SharePoint sites just from anywhere. And the cool thing also is that administrators can manage your laptop from anywhere in the world. So that's cool. Other cool stuff that is in R2 is the whole administrative tasks. They're all based on PowerShell 2.0. Now you have the Active Directory Administrative Center, which is a new console to manage the Active Directory. And it's all based on PowerShell 2, so you can script anything. Anything you can do in the UI, you can script. And you can script even more.
What do you think people... Do you think people are really jazzed about that live migration feature?
In live production systems, the quick migration, which is currently available, it's enough for 78% of systems.
Do you think, from what you saw in live migration, that that's a great thing to have? And do you think that we'll be seeing people switching from VMware on the strength of that? Or when they buy a new server, will they just take the Microsoft option rather than buying the VMware option?
No, I don't think they will switch their current VMware ESX infrastructure to Hyper-V. But like you said, when they buy new systems or plan new systems, they might choose for Hyper-V. And together with the System Center Virtual Machine Manager, they can manage both their current ESX systems and their new Hyper-V systems. Mm. So,
should VMware be worried, do you think?
Well, not yet. When R2 is released, then they have to start working. But VMware doesn't sit still, so I also expect more innovations coming from there.
Thank you very much, Stephen. That was great. One more point, Gavin, I wanted to bring up about Windows Client is something that's been going on in the services side of the Windows world, which is Windows Live OneCare.
Yeah.
Microsoft recently decided very suddenly and mysteriously that it's going to kill off Windows Live OneCare and its equipped service, which is a bundle for primarily for students and home small office users, which includes Windows Live OneCare and a number of other services together. They're killing both of these things off. We don't really know why. We know the effective date when they're being killed off is June 30th, 2009. And we know they're going to be replaced by a free security service from Microsoft that's codenamed Morrow, M-O-R-R-O. And that's all Microsoft will say. We don't know anything more than that. And I think it's going to be very interesting as things come to light about why this was done and whether Microsoft's competitors in the security space like Symantec mm-hmm. and McAfee may have some attempt at even an antitrust claim with claiming that Microsoft's cutting them out of the market by dropping the cost to zero. I don't know if they'll have a leg on that, but
it's also an interesting example of how Microsoft can't be trusted not to change the packaging. You should never launch it. You should never buy into a first version of a Microsoft product, either as a customer or as a partner. And this is what we've been saying about the Microsoft services for so long. Wait till Microsoft's got them done and dusted. Don't become an early adopter or a partner on this stuff because they'll change it. And they have changed it once again on this.
Yeah. And what's really mysterious to me is Microsoft launched Equipped, the bundle that includes Windows Live OneCare, in July this year.
Yep.
Now they have to go to every Circuit City and a number of the UK retailer chains and pull it out of the channel. So something very severe happened to inspire them to do this. It wasn't just something they did on a whim.
Yeah. It was never a really clearly explained package.
No.
They weren't clear whether they're going after the individual or they're going after the small business. None of that stuff was ever really clear. So there is a very good case. It's a legal issue, as you say. It could just be strategic rethinking inside of Microsoft itself, but whatever it is, it's not clear. Another thing that's been interesting to all of us has been the competition in rich internet applications between Microsoft and Adobe. Those two companies have been sparring for so many years now over the interface. And this time it's now taking on a new dimension, which is, as I say, the rich internet application. For Microsoft, that means that's involved spinning up a whole new product line called Silverlight, as well as improving the client development experience on Windows. Whereas Adobe is pretty much extending its existing Flash dominance into new areas with Flex and with Flex, sorry, and with Air. Convention has it that when your competitor has a major trade show or launches a lot of products, you don't announce competing news. Well, Microsoft actually did announce competing news, which we thought was kind of interesting. So we wanted to find out why. So let's cut into this. What did Adobe announce first of all? Adobe announced a preview edition of Thermo, which is its product to help developers and designers work together. It's now called Flash Catalyst. And as I said, there was a preview edition of that announced. Thermo will theoretically enable product designs built in Creative Suite 4 to be imported with all the necessary elements and workflows into Flash Builder. And also that will work with Flash Player and Air. A public beta is planned for 2009 on that. Also announced was something called Gumbo, which is the next version of Flex Builder. Also announced Kokomo, which is Adobe's attempt to add collaboration and social networking features to Flex-based clients. So that involves webcam, text-based chat, kind of cloud-based services there were kind of part of the mix. Adobe Air 1.5 Windows and Mac was actually released. That features the WebKit HTML engine in Squirrelfish. And then Flash Player 10, there was a lot of talk around that as well. What did Microsoft do? Well, Microsoft tried to rain on Adobe's parade. Scott Guthrie, of all people, blogged about Silverlight 3. Microsoft never gives a sneak peek of anything, let alone something as important as Silverlight 3. So, of course, we had to pay attention to this. What did Scott blog about? Well, hold on to your hats. H.264 video, 3D and GPU hardware acceleration. If anyone can explain that to me, then put it on the back of a postcard and pop it in the post. Also, that classic rich data binding in Visual Studio and Visual Web Developer Express. And Scott promised we have plenty of additional cool features which we're going to keep up our sleeves for a little while longer. I'll wager that's because they don't even know what those features are just yet.
I agree.
I get the feeling somebody put a gun to Scott's head and said, you've got to go there and announce something, Scott. Yep. So he came up with that. Also, it was interesting, Scott flagged up early adopters, like we'd forgotten who those guys were, NBC, Olympics, CBS and Netflix. Adobe, for its part, made a big play out of Major League Baseball, which to our British viewers probably won't mean much, but Major League Baseball gets a lot of guys, a big following amongst the male audience, as MLB.com. And back when Microsoft announced Silverlight 1, they made MLB.com was their big premier adopter. And now, surprise, it's gone over to Flash. So that name was dropped a lot this week. So, as I said, you've got to be feeling for Scott Guthrie. He had to announce something. But what's going on? Why did Microsoft do this? Why did he step out? Why did he feel he had to say something?
Yeah, I'd like to say one thing there, yep. Gavin, because I've been noticing Microsoft. You know, like you've pointed out, they don't like to talk about their competitors at all. That's a real strategy for them, and one that's worked in their favor. I mean, because they feel like any attention you give your competitor, you're helping them, even if it's negative attention. Yep. But I noticed there's been a little change on that on the Windows side of the house. You know, they kind of have been a little more responsive, and even if they're not saying the A word, meaning Apple, right out, they're definitely alluding more to Apple in their advertising and their marketing and their comebacks when Apple announces something. So, I mean, maybe this is a start of a new and different Microsoft, not always taking the quote-unquote high road.
Yeah.
It'll be interesting to see what they do there.
Well, I think in this particular case, there's a lot of corporate prestige at stake. Mm-hmm. And there's also a big attempt, I feel, here to bluff both the press and the analyst community and to basically try and bluff the opposition with all these big numbers that are being chucked out. Scott Pree's named to a press release that 1 in 4 consumers worldwide has access to a computer with Silverlight already installed, which I feel is a kind of a strange number, a strange statistic to spit out there, considering there's like only 1 million computers in the world and there's 7 billion people. My head started to bleed trying to do those maths. Even I know that's a very poor attach rate. Adobe, on the other hand, claimed that in the last year, this is something that's very interesting. Adobe's been claiming Adobe's increased its worldwide share of video on the web from 66% to 80% in while Microsoft Windows Media / Silverlight has dropped from 24% to 13%. That's a guy at Adobe's been saying that called Tom Barclay. Well, what's behind those numbers? well, as they say, there's lies, damn lies, and statistics. Silverlight, there's a lot of kind of like smoke and mirrors on both sides here. Silverlight is indeed a tiny fraction of the amount of video that's viewed online. There's no doubt about that. And Adobe's right to make that claim. You know, Microsoft can't come out and claim something like one in four consumers has access to a computer with Silverlight already installed.
Yeah, I think the other thing that we were chatting about earlier is just because a computer has Silverlight installed doesn't mean it doesn't have Flash installed.
Yep.
I mean, I think if you looked at most PCs out there, at least in the US right now, they probably have both installed. Or at least if you've touched any Microsoft website in the past, you know, six months, you've got Silverlight and you've got Flash.
Absolutely. And it's also, they're not saying which version of Silverlight either. What else we've got here? From my conversation with partners as well, such as Infragistics, they've been saying that Silverlight is in evaluation mode. No one's actually really using it. And you can see that as well. It's still early evaluation mode. On the other hand, Microsoft is trying to also big up its own site. They're talking about 70 million video streams and 600 minutes of the Olympics coverage was watched using Silverlight. Well, that's okay. And a lot of people thought, wow, at the time, but I ran some of those numbers. And when you compare that to the amount of Flash that's used using ComScore, you find out how small that number is. That number really is. For the whole month of July, there were 558 million hours of video was watched online. That's just in July away. So that's a really small amount. And of that, Google accounted for 44% of that traffic. That's 245 million hours. And a lot of that Google traffic is used Flash. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm not buying Adobe's numbers either. Having said that, you know, Adobe, why have they kind of stuck Windows Media and Silverlight together in that crafty little slash? You know, I think there's a case that Windows Media is dropping, but there's also probably equally said, I think Silverlight adoption and usage is rising, but from a base figure is zero. So it's going to take a while to get its numbers together.
I think it's going to be interesting too, Gavin, how and what Microsoft does to tie Silverlight into its own applications and services going forward. Like, we already know when they come out with Office 14 web apps that isn't going to require Silverlight, but if you have Silverlight, it's going to light up all these features in web apps that you don't have if you are using Flash. Mm-hmm. So I think this is how Microsoft also is going to try to grow the Silverlight market, not just by making its own websites and some of its partner sites require Silverlight, but also tying it in a way that they can't be sued by the Department of Justice, but still finding a way to tie it in with their own apps. And that's going to grow the share too.
I don't think they clearly know that the roadmap is on the Office for Web apps they announced a few weeks at PDC. They were saying you don't need Silverlight to view these, but it will help. It'll enhance your experience. It'll help you view things a lot crisper and a lot sharper. And that's a way of getting people to have to use it.
It is. And it's a way of keeping yourself from being sued because you can say it's not a requirement.
Yeah, absolutely. I thought it was interesting going back over the ComScore numbers. And the reason I'm picking on ComScore is because these are the stats that Adobe's been playing up so heavily to say that its share is growing while Windows Media / Silverlight is dropping. I found here that the amount of video viewed online has actually dropped year on year from this July compared to last July. Microsoft has actually gone up the rankings in the amount of video that's dropped from number 8 to number 3, but that's only as a result of the fact everyone else has dropped so far, and even Microsoft is down to single figure digits. And who do you think are the second or third biggest video properties online? Fox and Yahoo.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So they're the kind of people that Microsoft needs to be convincing to run its content in Silverlight, not MajorLeagueBaseball.com, which has actually a very small amount of people video streaming from its site. So much for the numbers. I spoke to Bola Atibi earlier. She's attended Adobe conferences and Microsoft conferences across the United States, and she's had a front row seat on what's actually happening on the technology front. Bola, what are you seeing? What's your impression of Silverlight versus Adobe Air and Flash Player?
Well, I think part of the problem is that there's always going to be people, you know, I mean, there's always going to be people in one camp trying to sort of push the Silverlight or Adobe Air or Flex. To be honest with you, I am seeing a lot of people using Silverlight, and I'm seeing a lot of people using Air, and I'm seeing a lot of people working in Flex and using Flash, and I am seeing people who are using the, you know, sort of Silverlight development environments. So the key thing to really take away from this is, look, at the end of the day, this is about the next generation of applications that are coming, and it doesn't so much matter whether it's Adobe or Microsoft. People have to wake up and realize this is a kind of the environment that we're going to be having to build our applications in. You know, it's about video streaming. It is about, you know, sort of richer immersive experience. experiences. It is about the interaction and the context for that interaction. It is about mobile devices. It's about, you know, sort of the mobility of applications. So at this stage, I think the argument of it, well, whether Silverlight is going to outwin Air or Air is going to outwin Silverlight is kind of a moot point, really. It's about, well, to be honest with you, it's about, well, how do we get people to realize and to understand the kind of applications that they can think about in the future and the kind of applications that they need to build for the future? And I think that is the real argument at play. I think the kind of Silverlight versus Air is a bit of a spat, and it's a bit of a sort of a kiddie's playground, you know, sort of argument, like my toy's bigger than yours. Not the argument.
Do you think we'll see people using, like, the same developers using both on a best of breed basis on what's called in, what's suited, or it'll be either or? People,
do you know what? I mean, I think people will come at it from multiple angles. They will come at it from a point of view of from designers who are very comfortable in the Flash, you know, and Flex environment, who are comfortable with Adobe solutions, with Illustrator and Photoshop, and, you know, and also the perception that, you know, Adobe's got a very strong design, you know, sort of community. So there's going to be a lot of people who will come there. You know, you cannot argue from that. Mm. But at the same time, Microsoft comes at it. It's also working hard on the design community. I think people are looking and listening. I think it would be wrong of us to say that, you know, we can dismiss them. We can't. I think they've taken a fair number of designers on board. And they, you know, they are talking very sensible, you know, a very sensible strategy. Microsoft is looking at it from the development angle. I think they have a strong story in that space. But I think the most important thing, none of the vendors, I mean, I don't think Microsoft or Adobe or even Sana, and we talk about others, are really sort of really talking about what this means for the, you know, the enterprise organization, the corporate developers. You know, how does this fit into their development teams? How does this fit into their natural traditional workflows, their processes? How does the makeup of the team change? What roles should they be bringing on board? Should they be thinking more about interactions? You know, I mean, these are the kind of questions that I think a lot of businesses and corporate development teams are going to be asking.
So should we talk about Novell?
Let's talk about Novell.
It was 2 years ago in November that Microsoft and Novell struck a pact that became one of the most reviled relationships in the tech industry. I think it's fair
to say.
That's
a fair comment.
So what Microsoft convinced Novell to do was to agree to a patent protection clause. In other words, Novell basically conceded, although its executives would not like to put it this way, that it was infringing on Microsoft patents with SUSE Linux, and it needed to protect its customers from a possible patent suit by Microsoft. In exchange, Microsoft agreed to distribute certificates to its customers for SUSE Linux. And in the first year of that relationship, I don't know if you remember, Gavin, but it was just so cantankerous. Mm-hmm. I mean, Novell's decision to go with Microsoft, which it did for self-preservation, basically, ended up really fragmenting the open source community and really making Novell a lot of enemies.
Yeah.
And then a few other companies fell into line because they got scared that Microsoft actually might make good on some of its threats. And we saw Zandros and Linspire, I think there were one or two other smaller vendors fall in and also sign patent protection clauses with Microsoft. Mm. Then we had the famous Microsoft saber rattling over Linux and open source violates 235 of our patents, and you guys better get in line. The one company that never did fall in line and stuck to its guns was Red Hat, mm-hmm. the one who Microsoft most wanted to hurt with the whole Novell relationship. So in the most recent year, we haven't really heard that much about the Novell-Microsoft pact, other than Microsoft and Novell occasionally dropping press releases claiming that customers really love the deal, and not much else. We didn't see other Linux vendors fall into line. We didn't hear a lot of back and forth over what Microsoft and Novell were doing. We know it helped Novell's business, and initially it kind of got them out of the slump that they were in. But more recently, Novell's earnings have been flat, and so it doesn't seem like the pact with Microsoft really is having the desired effect.
Novell's business is fairly flat. Its quarterly revenues are predictable. I can't see how the license has given it a fillip in any way whatsoever. One thing you could say, there's been technical interop between Linux and between Windows, which maybe has been sped up. The other thing is the ODF work that's been going along has probably helped between, you know, exchange documents between Office and OpenOffice. But, you know, a lot of us are seeing this, I mean, they're just scratching our heads. What did Novell get from the deal? What did Microsoft get from the deal? Right. You know, you say Red Hat was the low-hanging fruit and it refused to fall. IBM has not got in line to the pact. You know, Oracle, which has now got its own distribution of Linux, has not felt the need to kind of get in line behind the pact either. It's kind of not very clear. It's kind of, you look back on that kind of deal and you're kind of like, why did everyone get so bothered about it? And it put Novell, who was one of the probably one of the biggest light supporters of the Linux community, with the stance it took against SCO, it set Novell on the back foot.
Yeah, it really did. And, you know, I was talking to one of my colleagues about this deal, and he said, well, no publicity is bad publicity. That's one way you could look at it. So even though it really did stir up a lot of ill feelings in the open source community, did Microsoft and Novell really care? Because they were getting a lot of notoriety and a lot of headlines. Mm. And it really got Novell so much more on the radar screen of customers who it might not have been on the radar screen of. So I know the deal did hurt Novell in terms of public perception in the open source community. I mean, I still see the ill effects of that. Anytime you see Miguel Diaz-Casas speak, you really see people saying, you're a sellout, yep. You know, you're in Microsoft's back pocket. And it really kind of hurt the perception there. I'm not clear how much it hurt whether or not people would agree to contribute to projects like Mono and Moonlight.
Yeah.
Maybe you know more than that.
Well, I feel there's a feeling, especially I was speaking to people at the recent Adobe conference, Max, and there's a feeling that Microsoft has covered itself in kind of treaties and support and endorsements for open source. It simply doesn't make itself look good. And it's given over support to products like Miguel's Mono and Moonlight simply to say, so people can't attack it by saying, well, you hate open source. So it can say, hey, look, we're working with open source on these projects. And it's interesting to see how people like Brad Smith, who's Microsoft's biggest legal eagle, has got in line. And he sounds like he's changing his tune in terms of patents and open source. But, you know, he's not he might be the legal head, but he's not. He gets his paycheck from Steve Ballmer.
Right.
So is Steve's actually changing on this, I wonder?
Yeah.
Or is he just neutral on this right now?
I think he's more neutral on this. And I can't really feel for Sam Ramji and some of the people who are really trying to reach out to the open source community, because it feels like anytime they do something good, like working with Apache, you know, getting Microsoft to put more things under open source licenses, whatever it is, Steve Ballmer can, in one word, kind of undo all the goodwill that they've been building up. And this whole deal with Novell is an example of that. I mean, I bet if you asked some of the people at Microsoft, are you sorry you guys did the deal? I think you'd have a very mixed take. I think not everybody there would think the deal ended up being a positive.
Right. Same MJ. I know your idea of a good time is to relax with a copy of the New York Times and a good vodka martini, but I know you like this even more. It's the Todd Bishop patented Steve Ballmer Mood Index.
Woohoo!
We still haven't hit Monkey Boy yet. I'm still waiting for that day. What is Steve Ballmer's mood this time? And as you know, we take Steve-O's mood every show because he's emblematic of Microsoft. And just to give you a countdown, what are the options that we have on the table in front of us? Frustrated, intense, all business, not taking no, victorious, or monkey boy? And MJ, you gave it some thought. What mood do you think Steve-O's in this show?
I've got to say Steve's really feeling victorious as of this show.
Why is that?
You know, it wasn't that long ago that people were calling for Steve Ballmer's head over the whole Yahoo deal, saying he had just mungled that whole deal and it was really a disaster and he should be fired. Well, we know now whose head rolled as of this deal, and it's not Steve Ballmer's.
Right.
Jerry Yang is now out, and Yahoo is looking for a successor to Jerry Yang.
Now, you've been hearing maybe Yahoo might be looking to Microsoft for a new CEO.
I know. That's such a crazy rumor, but sometimes the craziest rumors are true, aren't they? And yeah. Some of the names that I've been hearing bandied about on the Microsoft side are, I've heard Kevin Johnson, who is the executive who used to head Microsoft's platforms and services business before he went to Juniper recently. Mm-hmm. And some people are saying he may be pulled away from Juniper to come back and head Yahoo, which would be very crazy since he was the Microsoft exec really leading the charge for Microsoft to buy Yahoo. Mm-hmm. So that's one possibility. I've also heard Brian McAndrews and Yusuf Mehdi, who are two of the top three guys in the search business at Microsoft right now, being talked about as potential candidates to be the new CEO of Yahoo. Again, pretty crazy, but it would make a Microsoft fit a lot easier if they brought one of those guys in.
And this hits the core problem that Yahoo is facing. It's that you will be CEO with a view to selling the company onto somebody. You're a transition CEO. You're not going to be a CEO in your own right.
Maybe. We don't know. Like, maybe the Yahoo board will say, let's go it alone and buy AOL and try to make a case for ourselves. I mean, I think that would just be nutty. But I also think it would be nutty if Microsoft bought Yahoo at this point.
I can't see Steve visiting that deal, but you never know.
I know. I think what's much more likely, and I think if people were putting a betting probability on it, this would be the winning bid, would be Microsoft doing some kind of a deal, either buying Yahoo Search outright or doing almost like the same deal that Microsoft managed to table between Google and Yahoo, kind of a search outsourcing deal where Microsoft would end up being the one to sell Yahoo's its display and online advertising ads.
I'm a purist. I mean, I believe M&A should be a pure and simple thing. Buying portions of people's businesses never really works out, does it? I mean, they're either going to buy the whole thing or they're not going to buy the whole thing. And after coming close to losing his follicle-less scalp this time, Steve-O's not going to go in for some kind of half-assed deal, I don't think. He'll want it like either we buy it or we don't. But Yahoo's got a lot of properties out there, a lot of Hotmail, a lot of Yahoo users, a lot of email users, but who knows. That's all we've got time for this show. I'm Gavin Clark, software editor of The Register.
And I'm Mary Jo Foley with ZDNet's All About Microsoft blog. This was Microbyte, brought to you by the people who bite the hand that feeds IT.